So what I'm going to do is try and sort of get into how I have turned that kind of what is policy and what is policy change question into some published work. Okay, so to go into how the questions are useful and how the choices you make can be useful to, get from what is policy to here's an explanation of a very specific policy change. Okay, so we start with what is policy, then we start with definitions, like some total of government action, that sort of thing. And all they can really do for us is help us guide research rather than provide something definitive. And even then, if you look into more of this work, there's not really widespread agreement on how you do that kind of research, how you make a choice about how you define policy, and how you make a choice about measuring it. So I think the best thing for you to do is to recognize that uncertainty and to make a choice and back it up. Okay, just like you would do with any ambiguity or definitional problem. You note its existence, you make a choice about how you deal with it, and then you show why you've made that choice. I think that's the best you can do. You're not going to get a definitive thing. So let me go through using the example of tobacco, how you could go through those questions we talk about. So, first question would be, if policy is the sum total of government action, does that include what policymakers say they will do as well as what they actually do? So your first big question is, does policy really the statement of intent or the actual thing that happens? Now that comes up with tobacco in that almost every country in the world has made a written commitment to a huge amount of tobacco control. But if you look at what they've actually done, only a small number of countries have followed through. Most of them haven't. Okay. So that sort of question helps you identify that kind of unevenness in practice. Second question would be, does it include the effects of a decision as well as the decision itself? Because what you tend to find with policy is the consequences are intended and unintended. So we have to ask ourselves, does policy include the things that weren't supposed to happen, or is it just some focus on what was supposed to happen? Now, it gets kind of circular and complicated when you know that if people know that there will be unintended consequences, they essentially become intended consequences. If I'm in government, I know that there'll always be a problem with something I do, and it's a choice to do it nonetheless. Okay. Now, I think with the tobacco example, some of the tobacco instruments they introduced were, so-called evidence-based or evidence-informed, but some of them were very speculative, and people knew that. You were making a policy, and you were engaging in kind of a form of trial and error to see what happened. So I would say that's part of a policy process, just as much as the selection of something is going to work. And the third question would be, what is the government? And does it include just elected policymakers, or does it also include unelected policymakers? And that's we spent a bit of time talking about networks of policymakers and influencers, those who are in charge and those who are working with them, those who are formally in positions of power and those with informal influence. And it's difficult to capture the extent of policy and policy change without asking, what the government is and how far it stretches. Okay, and I think, look at tobacco, and it's a kind of history of lots of policymakers and influencers making changes. You wouldn't capture it just by focusing on governments. And then the final question, does public policy include what policymakers do not do? If you look at the history of tobacco policy, at least from one perspective, from the perspective of people identifying tobacco as as the biggest non-communicable disease epidemic, then they would say the post-war history is about governments deciding not to do anything about a hugely important problem. And that's the thing most worthy of study. In fact, I think if you look at that kind of a lot of the public health literature, it is about trying to explain why governments don't do the things they have the evidence they think they should do something with, control tobacco, control alcohol, reform food policies and so on. So for a lot of advocates, that's the biggest policy thing to explain is the lack of policy itself. Okay, so that's why that, you know, what governments do or don't do is such an important definition, because really we're trying to explain things they don't do. Okay, so I think, you know, whichever case study you chose, that's a fairly straightforward way to think through the kind of ways you're going to think about and cover policy. It'll take some time, I think, for you to kind of relate it to the things you've just started to focus on. But I think with examples like tobacco, you can see that, you know, these kind of questions, definitions make sense. The trickier thing is to try and work out how much policy changed. And you've got quite a few choices to make here. And again, I don't really mind which choice you make as long as you make a choice, okay, and you show what it is. So one choice is to try and measure overall change over a certain period of time. You know, so I'm going to give you the example of tobacco, where it's a kind of overall narrative of how much change over decades. Or you can decide to identify one very specific policy instrument and one very specific story about change in that instrument, such as a piece of legislation or a code of practice or such like. And both foci are legitimate. And I would encourage you to just think of the sort of telescope metaphor, where you can choose to zoom out and try and cover everything in low detail, or you can zoom in and cover a very small part of the world in incredibly high detail. You know, so it's your choice. Both of those things give you what I hope would be complementary insights into the world, okay, as long as you do it well. Okay, so I would say there are two or three ways in which we would start to structure the identification of policy and policy change. A kind of classic, maybe the most classic, is the kind of Ted Lowy distinction. He did have four distinctions, but I think he would be known for the three, which is distinction between redistributive policies, distributive policies, and regulatory policies. And part of the reason he made those distinctions was to show the relationship between politics and policymaking, in that sometimes it's the nature of the problem that guides how people make choices, but sometimes it's the politics of the tools themselves. So in a nutshell, it's often much easier to regulate than to distribute resources. You know, you can introduce a piece of legislation to encourage or prohibit behavior. It's often much more simple than to tax a population and spend it on another population. And it's probably harder to go for redistributive policies in which it's very clear to the population that you're punishing some people with taxation and you're benefiting other people with services. That's a hard thing to do for governments, because they, you know, if they're trying to be elected. Whereas regulation is often seems like it's more universal, or it seems like it only applies to a small number of people. So he introduced those categories to describe the sort of political side to policy choices. Then you've got people like Hood and Margetts, who talk about policy tools, and I encourage you to find the words they use for these things. But in general, they talk about the government performs, you know, these kind of roles. One is they're a hub for information exchange. You know, their policy tool is to gather evidence and distribute it to other people. The other is that they regulate behavior more directly. Another is that they provide economic incentives or punishments for behavior. And another is that they provide resources to develop and implement policy, that sort of thing. Then you can get into a much larger number of policy instruments. So that would be laws, non-legal, or other kinds of regulations that aren't primary legislation. Taxes and spending. In my case, you know, health education or staffing, you know, that sort of thing. A whole bunch of things that you you bring together to describe policy change. And you can see in some cases why it would be difficult to describe policy without a combination of things. So, for example, if a government legislates for a policy change, then provides no resources to implement it, then you might think to yourself, well, this is a kind of placebo policy where they were actually more interested in making people think that they were doing something than actually wanting to do something. You know, so you need that combination of things to get a sense of policy. You would think if they legislate and then they don't put their weight behind implementation, that's a placebo. If they legislate and then do all they can to implement, and that's something else. Those are two different types of policy commitment. And then you can look at what the effects were. Now in tobacco, I think it's relatively simple to give an overall story of tobacco policy because there are so many governments and international organizations committed to these policies that they're relatively easy to identify. And I'll read out the list of those things, but the chances are this list will not be available to you and you'll have to piece things together much more in a more difficult way, unless you simply choose to find an area in which that's not the case. But it's more interesting, I think, to piece these things together. So let me go through this list and you can see what I mean. So the instruments that they are most keen on are the following. Taxation, so that's price measures to reduce demand for tobacco. Smoke-free policies, so that's things like bans on smoking in public places to protect people from exposure to secondhand smoke or environmental tobacco smoke or passive smoking. I used to say passive smoking. Would you say passive smoking? I don't know if that's kind of gone out. Yeah. Then there'll be regulations of the products themselves, particularly the toxic ingredients. So, you know, for a lot of the 70s, the focus was on, believe it or not, reducing the amount of tar in cigarettes. I think there is no tar in cigarettes now, but they used to be very tar-based in the olden days. So, you know, there'll be regulations to restrict the ingredients. I think if you buy them illegally, if you need that tar, I think you can buy the illegal products and get it. Ingredient disclosure, so that's regulations to make companies tell you what is in the packs. You'll see that more with food, wouldn't you? Health warning labels, and you know there are choices within that. So what proportion of the pack should the health warning have? And I think it's the WHO wants at least 30%, and they want them to be rotating. This took me ages to work out what that meant. In my mind, this was like a rotisserie, but it just means that they have a bank of images that they put on at different times. Okay, so each time you buy a pack, you get a different message. Okay, I mean, none of them are good. None of them say it's okay. But you know, rotating 30% packages, and increasingly the push is for plain packagings to reduce the branding. So I think in the UK, I only see packs when someone's left them next to my house. But I think now a pack, it really should be kind of sludge green with a picture of black lungs or something like that. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So the next one would be banning advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. So actually, I don't know if you remember. You have to be a certain age, but there was a golden era of snooker. When we all watched snooker, everyone, and it was always sponsored by Benson and Hedges or something like that. Okay, so those were the days, yeah, the glory days of snooker and smoking. But the sponsorship was banned, and tobacco companies used to sponsor, opera and that sort of thing as well. But they're no longer allowed to, at least in the UK. It would be banning promotion at the point of sale. So I think now if you go to a shop, the packs are covered and you have to ask for a product. And then Once or twice I've just gone just to watch. I mean, not in a weird way, but just to pretend to buy a lottery ticket just to see what happens. And it's really difficult, I think, to get a packet of cigarettes. Yeah, it used to be you could just point to them. Yeah. Okay, so this is the effect of policy. It'd be funding for smoking cessation services. So I think that is, I think if you can get free patches, and there's a chemical, the name I've forgotten, but you can take the
nicotine patches.
Yeah, but I think there's another thing as well, isn't it? That's there's a nicotine patch, and then there's another thing that reduces your craving for nicotine in the first place. Oh, right, okay. Well, whatever that is, I think you can get it on smoking cessation services. Investing resources to prohibit the illicit trade in tobacco products. So, yeah. That would come down to how much do you spend on customs and excise to do checks at the borders, that sort of thing. How much do you punish people selling illegal products in the market? And by the market, I mean, I don't mean the economics market. I mean the market down the high street. What else? Banning tobacco sales to people under 18, which is one of the least enforced measures, I think, in all countries. It's not too difficult to buy cigarettes if you're under 18. Harder now, I think. It used to be when I was young, you could buy a single cigarette from the van. Age didn't come into it. You just say, I'm buying it from my mum, you know. So, and it was 10 pence. So you could imagine this conversation. I'd like a 10 pence mix-up and a single fag. So that's no longer legal. Which I think is a little bit of a shame, that one. You know, I like the... also, litigation against tobacco companies. That's not really a feature of the UK, but it's a big feature of countries like the US. In the US, litigation against tobacco companies would be a significant policy measure akin to a tax, because there was a settlement the companies agreed to pay, which was essentially them giving money to government to pay for services. Funded research to monitor and evaluate tobacco control, and a key one, support for economically viable alternatives to tobacco growing. So Malawi is, I think, the most visible case where the big policy measure is to provide economic incentives to reduce the incentive to grow tobacco leaf. So there are some countries where it's actually, you know, okay for the economy to invest in tobacco because they can sell it. Okay, so that's a huge list. Imagine that's a huge list of measures that make up tobacco policy, and each country is doing a mix of those things, or it's providing resources for some or not for others. So you've got questions about what you do with that list and how you measure and how you analyze. So as I say, you can go for breadth, the big picture, or you can go for depth. You can talk about, now I suggest that you get in front of this. And that's just tricky. I think policy change relies on how much we expect it to change given the size of the problem we've identified. So advocates in public health are kind of unequivocal about that kind of thing. They say, here's the size of the problem. There's an epidemic to solve. Therefore, policy change does not live up to our expectations. Now, I wouldn't expect you to go quite as far as that, but I think you will have expectations based on the nature of the problem you identify, probably, you know, in most cases in your analysis. So your evaluation of the amount of policy change, I think it has some bearing or some relationship to what you would expect to happen given the problem you relate. So for me, given that you're really just, I'm your audience, it's fine if you say your question is something like, you know, why did this policy change take so long to happen, given that there was a huge problem that should have been solved? Or why did they do so much for such a small problem or something? I think that if you can state it as a puzzle, it makes it much more interesting. So, you know, so we're recording this, so I won't give you a hard time if you essentially you've got a real value judgment mixed up in the thing you're trying to explain. Because I think the choice is to express your value judgment or to leave it implicit. Then you might ask yourself, how radical does this thing look from the top if you're focusing on the choices by central governments compared to how it looks at the bottom, which might be, you know, longer term policy delivery. You know, the policy change looks very different from these two different perspectives. Then you might ask yourself what these policies mean. So for example, you might ask yourself what problem were policymakers trying to solve? Sometimes they go into politics to try and effect major changes in society for societal good. Sometimes they go into politics to become popular and the policy mean that they thought it would make them popular. So I think it's worth thinking about what you think they were doing, and therefore that will give you some bearing on what the nature of the policy change is or is likely to be. And when you're doing that, I think try and ignore, you know, my line is, the world is so complicated, I'm surprised any government succeeds in doing anything. Now, try not to think about that when you're doing this, because it really mucks up your analysis. But, you know, imagine you were a policy, imagine I was in government, and you were thinking, right, what was he trying to do there? Well, you were thinking, well, he thinks that he's not going to do anything, you know, so what's he up to? It must be some kind of performance. So you can ask yourself what other policymakers are doing and you know what they expect to find. And then how consistent it all seems to be. So the classic in tobacco is sometimes governments or, you know, say the European Union for a long time had an anti-tobacco policy overall, a huge focus on, you know, cancer and preventable NCDs, but also provided economic subsidies for some countries in the EU to grow tobacco leaf. Okay, so to my mind, this is a contradictory policy they've pursued. Okay, so you could factor that in. I think in lots of places you'll find these contradictions and you have to make sense of them. And so that means, you know, if you focus on one example of policy change, it's worth placing it into context of overall policy change, even if you're going to focus on one in particular. Okay. Then we get into, I think it's impossible not to measure policy change without implicitly evaluating success. I think when you describe it, in some way you're going to describe if you thought it was working out well or not. So there is this literature on how you measure and categorize policy success. And obviously that a lot of that's in the eye of the beholder, you know. So if you're keen on tobacco control, you would often use the UK as a relative success story. If you were keen on a limited role for the state, you would see the UK as the biggest failure in this field, you know, because they insist on, you know, state regulation. But if you're looking at success, I think often the literature focuses on three different kinds. The first is programmatic. So that's the kind of thing I was talking about there. It's about piecing together all the policy instruments or tools. The second one is process, which includes questions like, was this policy successful because it had a fair process in which everyone was consulted and people felt that they had high ownership of it, even if they didn't agree with lots of parts of it? Or was it a political success? You know, did it make them popular? And I think those categories can often help you explain amounts of policy change, because sometimes political success does not match up very well with programmatic success. You know, sometimes a government can be more popular by being quite unambitious, for example. So there's this phrase that would often be used, which is you can have ideally what you want with an action is it represents good policy and good politics. But a lot of the things we study are either good politics, bad policy, or bad politics, good policy, or something like that. Okay, and those kind of measures of success help us think about that. Okay, and then a final measure of success and change might be how long it is endured without being reversed. So I don't know if you know, I think it's in the Netherlands, some aspects of the ban on smoking in public places were reversed. I don't know, is anyone, I was hoping, I don't really know the details, I just know no one has gone to the Netherlands to enjoy the smoking regulations. No, okay. But I think a feature of the UK is that none of these things were reversed. They've got quite hard line. I don't know if we talked about this before, where if you leave the UK and you go anywhere else, you smell smoke much more. I'll look out for that. Okay, I don't know, I'm sounding kind of weird. I'm going around watching people buy packs of cigarettes and trying to sniff public places. But I think you really do notice the difference in the UK. Okay, so that's us getting into measurement and definitions. But still, when I look at these things, it's still not clear what I'm trying to explain in the UK, because you could be trying to explain major paradigm change. So clearly, if you look at the 50s in the UK and you look at the modern day, policy has changed in a fundamental way. But you could also focus on key periods and ask, why was policy change so minimal for so long? So I think in the UK story, you would say, why was there a gap, 20 to 30 year gap, between the identification of evidence on smoking and what you might describe as a proportionate response? So even in this field, you can identify major or minor change, or a lot of it, or fast-paced or slow-paced. And again, there's no real agreement. There's no calculator you can go to and you can put in these instruments, and it will tell you that's major change or minor change. These are judgments that you'll make. And again, as long as you make a clear judgment and you show why, then I think you're doing well. But I think you have to make that choice before you try to explain it. So before you get onto the theories and concepts we talk about, I would be clear on the story you've got about the nature of policy change. So normally, I think in the context in which I would describe in this chapter, what I'm trying to do is explain major policy change in relation to most of the rest of the world. So the thing that marks the UK tobacco regime out compared to all but a handful of other countries is that its policy change was comprehensive, and it meets the requirements of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, okay, and most countries don't. So I'm trying to explain why it has gone much further than almost every other country. And so this chapter is handy in two ways, because it shows the two ways you can go. One is the big picture, and quite simply with reference to the concepts we talked about in MPP1. Okay, so the big picture is there's a paradigm shift in tobacco policy overall. How can we explain it in general? Okay, so we can do it with reference to the concepts. So one is, policymaker psychology and the importance of framing and telling stories about particular cases. So you would say in the UK, policymakers understood this problem in a very different way over time. From the 40s, they largely understood tobacco as an unimportant policy problem, a glamorous product, and something that brought in a lot of taxation revenue to the UK. So there was a famous quotation, in the 50s, the health minister pretty much said, tobacco tax pays for our NHS. It's 15% of all our revenue. If people didn't smoke, you couldn't get a hospital care or something like that. So back then, tobacco was framed largely positively or received very little attention. But now clearly, I think successive UK governments describe it as a global public health epidemic that they should play their part in preventing. Okay, so there's a clear shift in framing the problem, which can be linked partly to the scientific evidence on smoking directly or secondhand smoke. Then, if you remember, we had these other concepts. So one was there were many actors spread across many levels and types of government. And so what you find in tobacco is that there are many different bodies making policy changes that add up to what we call policy change. So in the chapter, it goes into, for example, the shift by devolved governments. So it wasn't just central government, or it could be particular agencies that make these changes. And then you could talk about, there were key shifts in venues and institutions. So one of the big things was that over time, the health department became the primary policymaker, and treasury and trade departments became less important. You can see why that would matter, because their roles would be to consult public health people to gather health-based information, whereas trade departments were making their case based on exports and balance of payments. Economic departments make the case based on taxation and economic growth. And you can still see those economic arguments play out in other countries. So for example, the Japanese government still is the biggest shareholder in JTI, a big multinational. The Chinese government owns the Chinese tobacco company, and these companies make money for governments, you know, so they would understand policy with reference to this economic benefit. Whereas in the UK, through choice or through necessity, they don't. It's been a long time since the UK government has made the case that tobacco use is a good thing for the UK. There'd be a shift over time of interest groups. So in the post-war period, it was tobacco companies who were the most the strongest insider groups, and now the UK government's made a commitment to not consulting with them formally at all. And it's been a shift attention to socioeconomic factors. So the three big ones in tobacco would be fewer people smoke, they smoke less, attitudes to tobacco control are more favourable, and tax revenue from tobacco has gone down. So the socioeconomic environment is more conducive to policy change. And then finally, you might talk about events. You know, we talked about events that were unanticipated or they were routine elections. And the elections really matter in the UK because it tended to be Labour governments who are more keen on tobacco control than Conservative governments. So a lot of the big changes happened after 97, during the Blair years. I guess some of you are of a certain vintage where the Blair years were the Iraq War, and that was it, really. Well, but they also banned smoking in public places. Okay. So that would be a kind of broad narrative you could provide. And I think if you did that well, that could be your coursework if you chose. I think, you know, if that looks comprehensive, then fine. Or you can do something different or a combination of these things, depending on how ambitious you want to be. Now, I don't know, right. Now, I know we're from different backgrounds, right? So I need to be careful how I say this, right? I think there's a British way of using certain words which are sarcastic, but you wouldn't pick this up because I have mastered routine sarcasm to the extent that if you really listen to what I say, I'm routinely lying in a sense, but the rule is that I'm not lying. Okay, so hang on, I need to remember where I've said this. So when I say how ambitious, you can be ambitious and do all these things, essentially I'm saying this is a bad idea. Okay, so I don't know if that would be clear. If you read Yes Minister, the word used to be courageous. You know, you want to do that thing? Well, that's very courageous of you. What they mean is, under no circumstances do that thing.
Okay. They want us to be reasonably ambitious?
Yes. Okay. So sometimes I'll say ambitious is a good thing. Sometimes I'll say ambitious as in this is a bad idea. But most of the time I like to leave it ambiguous for fun. Okay. So that's really what the whole course is designed around. I never want you to be sure what I'm saying to you. Okay, and that's a good example. So if you want to be really ambitious, you can combine these two things. And the benefit of the ambition is that you're considering lots of different things from lots of different angles. The more perspectives, the better. The downside is that I think in, what would be the proportion, 9 out of 10 cases, when people try it, it doesn't quite work out. And it's a bit like too many ingredients in a cake or something like that. It just, it's ruined. I don't really bake. I don't know if this is a good analogy, right? But I don't know, you've put in, it's some weird sesame seed, cranberry and cocoa nibs nonsense. You know, the nibs tipped it. Actually, I don't know if you've bought cocoa nibs. Oh, I bought, right, I know I'm recording this, right? I bought cocoa nibs because Terry Crews got addicted to them on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. You make them look so tasty, right? But they're horrible. They're really, really bitter. Okay, so don't make that mistake. What I'm really saying is it can be just as good to choose one theory out of the whole bunch and do that well as to try and combine lots of different theories. I don't want you to get the impression that I'm saying to you, you must combine many theories. I would treat it a bit like my old-time favourite analogy was the Olympic diving, where you get a combination of scores. You get a score for the complicated manoeuvre and for the execution of that manoeuvre. Now, you can do well by executing something really simple perfectly, or you can do well by executing a really complicated thing not well, okay? But there comes a point in diving when you do, I don't know, I don't really watch it that well, but you know, you do that sixth, I'm thinking loop-de-loop, it can't be called a loop-de-loop, sixth somersault, and then you land on your stomach, and it's a disaster, yeah. You don't get any credit for the five somersaults before it, you know, so you need to make that choice yourself. How complicated do you want to make this? And I'm just saying it's okay to make it quite simple. Okay, so one example of a simple explanation would be using multiple streams analysis, which I do in this tobacco case. And I'll say something about the tobacco case and then kind of contradict myself. But it's useful with tobacco because you're trying to work out the role of key actors that we call entrepreneurs exploiting windows of opportunity for policy change. And that they happen when three things come together. There's high attention to a policy problem. Suddenly high. So you find that with tobacco, lurches of attention to tobacco as a problem. At the same time, there is a solution to that problem available. And it is technically feasible, which is if you implement it, it'll work. And it's politically feasible, which means that it's not too unpopular to rule it out. And then that coincides with the temporary motivation and opportunity of a policymaker to turn it into policy. So what you would find in a lot of the UK cases is there was this temporary motivation to adopt a ban on smoking in public places. And if you look into the circumstances surrounding it, an incredible series of events and choices had to be made for the complete ban on smoking in public places to be the most feasible. You know, if you look at it from any other point in time, the most feasible most of the time was going to be an exemption for clubs and for parts of pubs and that sort of thing. But they went for the full ban for quite intricate reasons that you could explain in some depth. And that's one of the reasons why you might choose to focus on one particular example, because it gives you the space to go into the series of events that seem to be important. In fact, I'm just trying to think what they were in the UK. I mean, weirdly, one of the events was, to some extent, was the Iraq War. So this is smoking ban in the UK, the Iraq War and ID cards. No, you remember the ID cards, at one point, the Blair government wanted to introduce ID cards in the UK, which meant if you were a UK citizen, you had to carry photographic identity. That was in part to anticipate issues of freedom of movement within the European Union. But they had such a sort of rebellion from their own MPs, they were reluctant to do too many things to upset MPs in other cases. So that contributed to a free vote on smoking in public places. And that contributed to most MPs going for it. Okay. So, you know, you can really get into all those kind of details with if you focus on particular things. So your choice is, you know, do you want a big broad story or do you want a really specific kind of vignette? Now, if past performance is a guide to future performance, most people go for multiple streams because it seems like the most intuitively appealing theory. It's the easiest to pick up. It's the easiest to apply because it's basically a metaphor about windows of opportunity and that sort of thing. Okay, now that's fine. If you all end up doing that one, it's not unexpected. Okay, but. Yeah, okay. I won't judge you too harshly. I'll just say to do that well requires reading a huge amount reading a huge amount of, come on Fred, almost there. A huge amount of material on case studies written since 1984. Okay, so don't go for the read the blog, skim the book, do the case study. Okay, because almost everyone ends up doing that. And you're better than that. We know this. Okay. So, I think that's it. I think that's it for now. I think I've got to do the...